everybody. I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond. Welcome to the PTSD and Beyond podcast, where we give you insights into post-traumatic stress, trauma recovery, healing, and beyond. I'm Dr. Deb Lind, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind, touch your heart, and connect with your spirit, and also give you a greater understanding of yourself and others on this healing and recovery journey walked by so many of us before, wounded healers with lived experience and heroes. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into possibilities and purpose, hope, and inspiration. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. One last thing, guys, before we dive into today's episode, if you'd like an ad-free experience and like early access to new episodes and special events, I want to let you know you can join us at patreon.com. That is patreon.com/PTSD and beyond. All right, let's do it. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond. See, I'm really excited to talk about the bio of our guests today. And why I'm excited to talk about them is because I have a bias in our industry of people who continuously get education and don't add to the body of knowledge. They regurgitate, they redo, but what additional innovative techniques are being explored, created, implemented, and developed in mental health care? Where? What do we have? What do we have? Well, today's guest actually is an innovator in the sphere of mental health. He is the executive director of the NLP Research and Recognition Project with over 33 years of experience in executive, clinical, and research roles. After the 9/11 attacks in 2001, he created a rehabilitation plan for 800 survivors of the World Trade Center attacks using neuro-linguistic programming, which is NLP, to treat post-traumatic stress symptoms more quickly and effectively than other therapists. He actually shares part of his story in our podcast episode today. His successes in this role led him to establish a nonprofit organization to advance, to advance NLP research and ensure that it meets rigorous scientific standards. So what does all that mean? It means this person innovates. It means that they're committed to the field of folks that are suffering. They've identified a methodology that is effective and that it meets rigorous scientific standards. His academic background includes a master's degree in clinical psychology from St. John's University and a PhD in psychology from the Institute of Psychiatry in London. He's held teaching positions at Cornell and the New York School of Psychiatry. In addition to his work at the NLP Research and Recognition Project, he has extensive business experience, serving as president and chairman of the board at Flowers Management Corporation and co-owning Clinical Associates in the Southern Tier. His commitment to NLP was solidified after using the techniques during his own battle with cancer, which led him to dedicate his life and his efforts to promoting the recognition and application of NLP. Since 2006, he has focused on the NLP Research and Recognition Project while maintaining a private practice in Corning, New York. All right, guys, I'm super excited to introduce Dr. Frank Burke.
All right. You had some questions, Deb?
Yeah, I did. You were talking about going down to 9/11. And I'd like to hear your story on that one. And then if you could share with our listeners some of the work that you're doing with RTM what does it mean and how it's helping folks, that would be fantastic.
I'll try to be parsimonious. We old professors tend to go on and on and on. Anywhere along the line, just, you know, give me the high sign. Enough of that one, Grandpa.
This space is yours. Yeah. So however you want to do it, it's how we roll.
Well, the story we should really start. I went down to 9/11 as a professional volunteer to help with the problem and stay and wound up taking responsibility for 850 survivors from above the 100th floor. 250 of them had serious PTSD, which I was able to treat with a protocol that I had picked up in my travels that was remarkable. I was triaging the clients I treated for severe PTSD with clinicians in the New York City area, about 50 of them, to provide the long-term support needed after the PTSD traumatization, et cetera. And the feedback was, well, what are you doing there? What, you know, we're all just holding hands and trying to help, and you're getting rid of the basic symptoms before you send them to us. And I said I was using an NLP-derived protocol and my own adaptation to it, and it was working in 2 to 4 hours to get people back to work, which is what they needed. The people I took care of were had to rebuild their corporation.
Sure.
And all of their computers, et cetera, had gone down with the building. So get them getting back to work and able to function was a high priority for all of them and the organization that I was helping. So I stayed down there for about 11 months. It was the most rewarding clinical time of my life, you can imagine. When you have something that is really helpful in a situation like that, the personal rewards are hard to put into words. It's served me for a long time in a big way. But after I got done with that, I found out that I had not been paying close enough attention to my body, and I had a diagnosis of terminal cancer.
Oh, wow.
So like all, terminally diagnosed people, I went and did all of the Western medicine work that I could do and my own Eastern work. And miraculously, after about a year and a half, 2 years, realized that I had survived and would have to think now not about what to do in heaven for the next millennium or thereabouts, but what to do here on earth. And given I was trained as a research scientist at the Institute of Psychiatry in London, I realized what it was going to take to get an effective protocol into general utilization.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that with a bunch of friends, a nonprofit, to bring the RTM protocol, which is what it's called now, to develop it so it could be researched scientifically and disseminated. Got a bunch of experts together from the NLP world. We took about a year to refine what I was doing. And then subsequent to that, found that a new neurological hypothesis called reconsolidation had a close resemblance to what we were doing with the protocol, and then upgraded we rebuilt the entire protocol so that it systematically accomplished the neurological process of reconsolidation. So what I was doing was like 50-60% effective, which was still 20-30% better than anything that was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got done with the RTM protocol, it has in the four subsequent studies that we've done with the nonprofit corporation shown that it's over 90% effective in getting rid of PTSD and all the symptoms.
Wow.
Well, if I would have had any brains, I would have said that it was much more effective than any of the previous treatments, because when you say something like PTSD can be remitted over 90% of the time, The next question is, you know, are you also selling Brooklyn Bridges?
Well, that's only because of what the conventional world and the conventional treatments are that hold the majority of the space, which is why I'm glad that you're here on the podcast to talk about, you know, this protocol.
The remarkable thing, Deb, is that it really works that way, not just in the scientific laboratory, mm-hmm. but we've gone on the nonprofit with the development, because if you don't have a training program that can get professionals to really duplicate what you've discovered, what you've put together, then you wind up with, you know, something that's effective in the research publications, but in general utilization goes, you know, from 90 back down to 60 or 70, because it's not being, when we put all of that together, we now have a manualized training program. We've trained 300 or so counselors here in the United States and measured their ability to remit PTSD so that we do the training in a very different fashion. First, we do the training online, takes 3 days. And then we leave the clinicians 3 months to treat two people successfully who've been diagnosed with PTSD. And they measure their administration of the protocol pre and post with the scientific instruments that validate diagnosis, et cetera. And mm-hmm. we don't certify them to administer the protocol until after they've treated two people successfully and gone through a test, a verbal testing with the coach to know that they understand and can administer the thing properly. Right. So we don't just have the research done. We have a training program that is really duplicating the research results for general practitioners in the real world.
And that increases validity and reliability. It's like a recipe. You know, if I'm going to make banana bread and I'm teaching somebody how to make banana bread and they can successfully make banana bread on a regular basis utilizing this research, then it shows that, yep, the effectiveness of the recipe as well as the quality of the output of the product. What is the name of the nonprofit? Let's give a plug.
Yeah, it's the Research and Recognition Project. So that if you want to look at the website, it's randrproject.org. R-A-N-D-R project.org.
And we'll have everything in the hyperlinks in the show notes too. So
they've got all the research, all the testimonials, you know, explanations, the board, the whole routine. But where we are now is we're trying to get the thing disseminated. It's like, you know, I have over my desk here a sign that says 33 today.
Yeah.
That's been up there for over 10 years. And I'm sitting here with a real solution to those people's problems and the moral obligation.
Yeah, right.
To get it out to the people who need it. And luckily, you know Montel Williams, the TV host?
Yes.
We've become good friends. What a marvelous human being. He came on board, you know, once again, said, you got to be kidding me. Verified that the thing worked really the way it does, and then has put his shoulder to this thing with me for the last 10 years. And he's brought a large number of influential and respected people into the project so that it's getting the kind of gravitas now to where we're going to be able to get it out to the people who need it. Over the next, couple of years.
Is there any criteria that need to happen in order for someone to get trained other than, a licensed clinician? Can it be somebody who, say, has a mental health first aid certificate? Or what's the criteria for folks to be certified?
What we have to do in order to maintain the project is to only train licensed mental health workers. They have to be licensed in one of the states. And for instance, the people we trained in the Ukraine are all licensed in the Ukraine as therapists, mental health workers. If we train, and the protocol is easy to administer, you know, most competent people could learn it in the sequence that we have the training package together. But if there were to be an accident and people said, wait a minute, what are you doing having a non-licensed mental health person administering this kind of therapy? And the project would be gone.
Yep, the risk, right?
Yeah.
I was thinking about, do you ever think that there might be an adapted version for folks in fire service and EMS, for example?
You don't have to adapt it, Deb. We've done I've done the protocol literally now on about 500 people, probably 150 Vietnam vets, many of them with 40, 50 years of nightmares.
Yeah.
Probably 25, 50 EMTs, policemen. Lovely detective from New York City who was shot up in a mafia exchange and carried that for 10 years. Now, the protocol is applicable for anyone from any traumatic injury, from rape to firefights in Vietnam and Afghanistan.
What's a wish list? So we're in over 120 countries. We're in the top 1% globally. And all obviously many different types of listeners. Everything from leadership to folks that actually are affected by post-traumatic stress. What's a wish list? How can our listeners help in this cause?
Right now, getting out the word that there is something that really works. And hopefully that will strike the ear of some genuine philanthropists at a high level. We're at the point where we have everything developed, but it's going to take, $10, $15 million to blow up the training and the dissemination so that we don't take another 20 years getting this out to the people who need it.
Right.
Getting the word out. That's really, we're in the stage now where it's pretty much evidentiary medicine, and we've raised the hackles of all of the current therapies and proponents thereof. And that's just human nature. That's not anything evil or
right.
You come up with something that is this much of an advance in the medical field, and if you look historically at penicillin and
Washing hands. Gosh, back in the day, I mean, you can read the history on washing hands, changing garments.
55 years.
Yep, that was considered just ridiculous, right? Not using leeches. I mean, there's many practices that were acceptable that were considered normal. And then, something as simply as washing hands was considered to be like, why? Right.
I oftentimes say now, in terms of myself, because the thing really is catching on, be careful what you pray for.
Right.
Watch your wish list, because I'm 81 and at the moment, still running 50 hours a week to keep this thing going and get it going.
And it's a passion. You can hear it in your voice. It's a passion. It's a mission. It's a calling. It probably fuels you every day. It fills your bucket.
Yeah, I don't know if you know Chinese medicine at all, but they say when you find your Tao, what you're doing is not just what you're supposed to be doing, but what makes you the happiest.
Right.
And that's kind of where I am. Not happy with the results in the sense that this thing really needs to get out there. If you're familiar with the field, I know you are. I read your bio stuff, etc. And anyone who understands the debilitating nature, never mind someone like myself, who has lived it, with 500 people and felt, empathized with their suffering, it's not an accident that so many suicides are associated with living with PTSD. It's not, people don't understand. And I'll tell you another lovely story. When I went down to New York with my PhD and my clinical, sign on the door, professor from Cornell University, I went in to help It was about the third day, fourth day, maybe 2 weeks after 9/11. And a woman, I was called down to an executive's office, actually. She was a manager with the company. And she was under her desk and was too frightened to come out. And I coaxed her out, got her in the chair, got started, et cetera, doing what I could do. And she said, I know you mean well, and I know you're very, you know, you're from Cornell, you're doing this for us at a great, you know, personal expense to yourself, et cetera, but you don't understand. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, and this is now 3 weeks after 9/11. I was at 9/11 5 hours ago. She said, I didn't dream about it in the past tense. I relived it, not knowing that I was dreaming it or reliving it. And emotionally, it's going to take me another day or two to recover emotionally and get okay. And it was a good lesson, if you know what I mean. I was trying to talk her down, and she wasn't coming. I mean, it was like I had met her the day after,
yeah,
and was trying to get her okay going back to work. That's literally for her where she was psychically.
Yeah.
Taught me a great deal. I learned clinically a great deal those 3 months after, and personally, it stretched me. By Christmas, I didn't know enough in administering the the work to dissociate myself. And so I was empathizing, which meant reliving the stories myself.
Yeah.
And that biology is at the level that those people were debilitated, huge.
Yeah.
So by Christmas, I came home and I scared the hell out of I scared the heck out of my wife.
It's all right. We swear on this podcast. There's no shame in it. Besides, you're from New York. Come on. You know, I mean, I expect it.
Oh, it's worse than that. I drove a cab in Manhattan during graduate school.
Maybe we need to have another episode, because it sounds like there's some lived experience stories right there that, you know, it'll make us laugh, right? You can't be upset and laugh at the same time.
And Lord knows, you know, the spiritual value of humor and that laugh is impossible to think too much of.
That's right. That's right. You mentioned about how this changed you, and as well as, you know, it sounds like it affected your body too. And I'm wondering about if reflecting back on some of those experiences of seeing people change and develop, right, having their own breakthroughs, what did that mean for you as a person, not as a clinician or a practitioner, but just as a regular person?
You know, forgive me, but I'm an old-fashioned Christian. I think that we have a God plan inside of us that we're meant to live, and when you do that in accordance with the plan, you are the happiest, the fullest, the most productive that you can be. I think that when you put together, you know, the role, you know, here comes Dr. Burke, the person who is, according to the sign on the door, supposed to help. And he helps, and that in a very, very profound way in terms of relieving traumatic memories, nightmares, flashbacks, and really hypervigilance, the cessation of life as they knew it prior to the traumatization. And that, when done properly, is it a me thing? It's kind of a we thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's when it's, and understand, I think that that as much happens to you as you do. Obviously, I have that philosophy and all the rest that goes with it. But being a part of the divine plan in terms of making more we.
Yeah, right.
Is really enriching to your own persona. Much more, Deb. I mean, this has affected me much more as a person than professional.
Yep.
I mean, I'm on the, you know, a Fulbright Institute of Psychiatry, Cornell University, etc. But as a person, I know the difference between the egotistical BS that goes with that.
The regala.
And the real stuff.
Yeah, the human stuff.
And let me tell you,
stuff.
It keeps getting translated in these kind of podcasts it wants to get translated into this hero conversation. Oh, the great, you know, the founder, and I've done a lot of work and but there have been 40, 50 of us that it took to get this thing here.
Mm-hmm.
To say nothing of the thousands, huh? Who contributed to the field of psychology and my own learning, right, philosophy, et cetera, to go with it. And I think when you don't take that into your ego, but understand the we-ness to it, huh?
Yep, there's a humility with it. There's a difference. You can tell when you meet somebody when it's almost, I don't even say it's almost as if, but you can tell by the feeling of talking with somebody when the ego is so predominant. Even when they're talking about that the ego is not predominant, you can feel it.
Yeah.
Have you met a person? Have you ever met a person who says, I kid you not, this has happened more than once, I'm really an introvert. I'm not going to wait while you're drinking because I don't want you to spit your drink out. Because it's funny. They're standing up on stage, right? With a microphone and everything. But yet they're saying, oh, you know what? You don't know how difficult this is for me. I'm really an introvert. And I kid you not, I'm sitting there thinking, you know what? I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid because guess what? Right? But how many times have we met people that are, there's this new phrase, right? Influencers. I don't listen to influencers. I listen to inspirers. And the reason why is because an influencer is looking at my pocketbook, but an inspirer, that person's looking at my spirit, they're looking at my heart, and they're looking at me. And they want what's best for me because they have a gift that they're sharing that, again, is what you're talking about, is about the we concept, right?
Yeah.
What could people do that are listening to podcasts that live with post-traumatic stress? How can they connect with someone who is trained?
We're going on the website, randrproject.com. One of the buttons will take you to a licensed clinician certified in the protocol. And there are 300 of them on there now, I think. And we're looking to get that to 1,000 in the next year or so.
Domestically and or internationally or both?
Mostly domestically for the 300 on the website. But like I said, we've trained 100 in the Ukraine. There are a number trained in the UK, France, Australia, Japan. It's spreading wonderfully.
Great. Because guess what? Here's the thing about the PTSD and Beyond podcast. In the month, I like to look at the statistics on, okay, so who's ranking where? And the United States tends to always be in the number one spot. I mean, we are a US-based podcast. However, Canada, UK, Australia, Germany, I love it. There's always this volleying. I never know exactly where it's going to land. And we've also had an increase of listeners in Japan. We've had, wonderfully, I'm so proud of this, being a Greek American, an increase of listeners in Greece and Spain and Portugal and Brazil and even in India. I'm really proud of the folks that come back every week and listen to existing like new podcasts as well as then previous podcasts. So are there any upcoming events that you'd like to share with us?
Montel and Clay Walker, the country singer.
Yeah.
They're putting together some events for the next year as fundraisers for the project. And what I'd love is someone out there who knows how to do, what do you call these things that catch fire on the internet? You know, these...
So something goes viral.
Yes, a viral. If anyone out there knows how to start a viral funding for the RTM protocol, please. What's clear is that it's going to take some amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
To get this thing into the mainstream and then blow it up quickly so that we have, 150,000 registered licensed therapists in the United States. We should probably get 50 to 75,000 of them trained in the protocol over the next 5-10 years in terms of, you got, 8% of the American population experiencing PTSD in their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
3.5% have it any given year. That's a lot of millions of people.
Right.
And
even people that haven't been diagnosed but are symptomatic may want to then reach out and say, hey, you know what? This is what I'm experiencing. And then that actually might be the catalyst to getting help. By knowing that there's actually something else that's available than what I would call the gold standards. That my argument is, if they were the gold standards and were effective as they claim to be, then we wouldn't be in this. We wouldn't be seeing the number of suicides that happen on a daily basis. Pick an industry, whether it's military, construction, law enforcement, legal, dental. No industry is immune from 100%. Zero suicides. And then also we have generations. We have, children in elementary school that are suffering. We have isolation studies by the U.S. Surgeon General. We can look at all the different data, and at some point it becomes, when are we going to help each other on a global scale to reduce and eliminate symptoms as well as increase the quality of life? Is there any quality of life metrics that we're looking at here? Can I get scientific for a second?
We wrote RFIs to a couple of very large proposals from the government when President Trump was in power that never got acknowledged. But essentially, with a remission rate for PTSD in our four published studies and the findings in the recent study from the UK done at King's College, the one coming from Walter Reed,
mm-hmm.
where you're showing a 2 to 3 times as effective remission of PTSD and all its symptoms, the correlates to that in terms of suicides, family problems, vocational problems, drug and alcohol abuse, there's a package of problems that, when the PTSD neurology has been remitted, allow for the comorbid pieces that we've measured that go with PTSD to also be effectively treated at a much higher rate and speed than when they're carrying the PTSD neurology itself. So that we're an evidence-based nonprofit, and we hope over the next 10 years to validate those generalizations with real numbers, good research in association with good universities. Right now, we have a study developed and joined with staff at MIT, Harvard, and ourselves to get at the underlying neurology for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can understand, we know that it's neurologically fixed, if I could say it that way, formatted.
Sure. Yep.
But to get at the actual neurology and have that to put forward in terms of validation. Right now, for a lot of the professionals, it's hard for them to buy into the level of efficacy that the protocol really carries.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to continue the research to get that going as well.
Are there any studies that are coming up that need volunteers?
Oh, Lord, yes. We'll be looking for between 200 and 500 subjects in the Boston area over the next 3 years.
Okay.
We're doing a pilot at MIT, and then we hope to expand on that and do some longitudinal neurology stuff there. We have probably 4 or 5 other research projects in the hopper, but they'll go forward almost of their own momentum at this point. We'll be at the IST, the largest conference for PTSD in the world, ISTSS, in Boston this year. We've presented over the last 2 years. And that makes kind of research waves and interests and gets collaborators out of the woodwork, et cetera. All of that is going forward. I don't have to sell it anymore. I have to try and keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Where the real problem is getting the money and interest to train the number of therapists that need to be trained, given the size and the spread of the problem.
Right.
We did a pilot training, for instance, with the New York State Department of Corrections,
mm-hmm.
and that went really well. And they went ahead and did a down and dirty, non-published, after we did the training, evaluation of the correction officers on the job with PTSD. What would you guess that would be, Deb? Corrections officers.
In a percentage?
In a percentage point. Working and having a diagnosable PTSD.
As far as how many people participated?
No. In of all the corrections officers in New York State, what percentage do you think are going to work every morning with PTSD?
Oh, 80%.
It measured in at 28.
28%. Really?
Well, first, you know, tough guys don't admit.
You're true. But that's true. They don't. I would have thought it would be higher. But yeah, okay.
I think it probably is higher than 28, but just the fact that those people are going to work. And in my what I would call experience in talking about it, people have gotten callous as to the effect that PTSD has on the lives of those affected.
Yeah, do you think that's stigma? Do you think that's stigma projecting?
I think it's stigma, and you know, especially in the world of first responders and armed services, etc. There's a lot of negatives.
Yeah,
you're not going to be
right.
A colonel in the army.
Yeah,
says I need mental health when you're a captain. Mental
right.
help.
Yep.
There's a stigma attached. And also, personally, one of the people I love to ask help, and this is related to the American Legion's You know, we have a resolution from the American Legion, national resolution, to support the protocol now. We've gotten that from a national level, and some wonderful people in the American Legion helping us go forward. But they have a program that they're sending around the United States called Be the One, by which they mean be the one who, when you see someone suffering, goes to both help them and get them to get help.
Yep.
It's really, really hard for especially our old school first responders to admit that they have a problem.
Right.
And ask for help in this context.
Right.
So that I'll bet you half of the people who have come to me for help personally have been dragged there by their wife or their supervisors, their children.
Yep.
There's a real reticence on the part of those affected to get help.
Yep.
And I would say to you mothers and wives, push harder. You hear the nightmares. You see the morning afters.
They're there sometimes to pick up the pieces too, because they see the real person. There's been many support for an outreach for spouses and partners, for sure. Yep. What are some other tidbits? What are some three last tidbits, facts, pieces of wisdom that you want to share with listeners?
Let me think. I made a list.
Did you? Okay, let's do it. Bring it on. You can read them too. It's fine. It's great.
Yeah, I think from my heart, Deb, if I stop. Please, we as a group of people, the ones I know here in the United States especially, and those I've encountered overseas, are not aware of the suffering that is entailed living with a traumatizing memory. And you know, the service life for PTSD in the VA is 15 years.
Yeah.
The Vietnam guys that I treated, many of them, their wives would come to me after the treatment and say, "What have you done? I have the guy that left when he was 18 years old back now, and he's 68 after the treatment." Their persona, their personality, their way of doing life is different. And while they can learn to cope, as got a large number of the Vietnam guys coming who came into retirement and without using their jobs as a coping mechanism, really went off the rails.
Right.
Had a huge influx of recent retirees from the Vietnam era who left with that space were not able to cope with the PTSD symptoms after. But I guess from my heart, it's don't let them get away with their John Waynes. And trust me, some of the worst John Waynes that I've treated were women in this context. I don't know if you saw, but one of the studies we did was out of Camp Pendleton of 36 women, more than half of which were suffering from MST, military sexual trauma.
Mm-hmm.
More than half of them, it was rape, etc. And the effect for them to be relieved of the internal neurology, their verbal testimonials are remarkable in terms of got my life back. The whole world is a different color. Just wonderful, wonderful stuff.
It's beautiful. Yep. Cycle breaker, changing people's lives. You know, does it get better than that at the end of the day when you look at yourself and say, yep, I did good?
And let me turn the tables on you. What would you say to our audience based on what you've found out about the protocol at this point?
I would say explore it and find somebody that you can connect with. Identify if there's someone on that list that you resonate with that you want to partner up and work with. Because I do know of the things that were supposed to work that don't work for a lot of people, and they're looking for something. They're looking for something. It reminds me a lot of the Penny George story in her journey of recovery, where we look at traditional modalities and then we get so desperate to try anything because the gold standards aren't effective. And because of that desperation, it allows us to be open to the possibility of trying something that maybe we wouldn't have considered had we not been in this place. So why wait to get to that place of desperation when there is already something that could possibly be a resolution? That's what I would say.
Much thanks. And that really resonates in terms of the number of veterans that I've treated who were through every protocol and medication associated or even minimally associated with PTSD with no success.
Right.
To have them own up to and come in and believe again that something might help.
So right. So hopeful, which is why we say take what resonates and go beyond. It's not just a tagline. It really is for folks that listen on a weekly basis. What part of this message, what part of this conversation, I say this often, what, you know, information goes here, right? But what stays with us, what resonates, touches us here. I'm going to move my here in our heart, right? That's what stays with us. That's what's sustainable. That's that everlasting gab stopper. And no, I'm not getting any kickback from Wonka. But you get the point, right? And it's true. So throughout the podcast, whatever message that Frank is sharing here, you know, again, all the information is in the show notes. Go look it up. And when you do connect, please say, hey, you know what? I heard you on PTSD and Beyond. This is what I'm looking for. If there's an investor out there that's thinking, oh, you know what? Because investors are always looking and they look at the weirdest places. And podcast, if I was an investor, I'd look at podcasting because this is where the organic innovation is happening. It's not happening in a lab. The innovation organic is happening in other types of communication modalities, if you want to call it, and podcasting is one of them. So you never know. You never know.
You know, there's something else I should add in, Deb, that I haven't.
Go ahead.
For a lot of the people familiar with the evidence-based gold standard treatments, they're painful to go through.
Yes, some of them are.
And the RTM, a lot of time you're just repeating feeling the terror until it desensitizes.
It numbs you.
It doesn't work very well. You got a huge dropout rate, and then it comes back in 6 months. But the RTM protocol is constructed. And by necessity, the client has to stay relaxed during the entire protocol. And essentially, they're reimagining or they're imagining movie scripts, a movie happening on the far wall, but staying completely relaxed and in their chair.
Yeah.
And they're seeing things in black and white rather than color and running them backwards rather than forwards and backwards in 2 seconds rather than real speed. And it's visual format changes while you're relaxed. And the last way you test it is you say to the client, look, will you tell me again about that horrible situation you had as an adolescent? Where you were sexually abused, or about you know, your best friend dying in your lap when you were in Vietnam, and they'll start to tell you the story again in great detail. And well, you know, I told you this before, but I was in Vietnam from such and such, and then they'll stop. Wait a minute, what have you done to me? I haven't been able to talk about this in 40 years
yeah.
without getting upset. And they realize, and this is after 5 hours of treatment, and they've had 40 years of traumatizing memory with this thing. And after 5 hours, they're saying, I can talk about it, and it's just a memory.
Right.
And that's what that's how the RTM program works neurologically. What it does is leaves the memory intact. Actually, it gets probably most of the time a lot more detailed. But it separates the traumatic feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas if you ask someone who's carrying a traumatic memory to tell you about it, they'll have a hard time not crying or breathing differently. They have physiological negativity coming so that it's pretty visible.
Right.
After the protocol, that's gone. So that the memory has been separated, the traumatic memory, from the traumatic feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been done in a fashion that's unconscious. The person doesn't even know in the course of the protocol as it's administered that it's happening. And it's not until they access the memory again that they can recognize that it's different and that the traumatizing element is no longer there.
Mm-hmm. And it's their awareness of knowing.
Yeah.
It's their awareness of knowing. I think that's beautiful. And this is a beautiful segue into saying thank you so much, Frank, for being here today and sharing all this.
Oh, thank you for giving us the opportunity to get it out. Really appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
All right, you guys, this is Dr. Deb with PTSD and Beyond. You know what I'm going to say next. And oh, by the way, when you do go check out Frank and his work. Let them know that you heard him on PTSD and Beyond. As always, we're better together, we're stronger together, and take what resonates and go beyond.